Venture through a wasteland twisted by dark magic, undead monsters, and contagious insanity where life and death are no longer opposites, but a spectrum of cruelties. Emerging from the dregs, an old king makes one final attempt to save his realm. Today's episode is brought to you by the newest project of Lee Ellis, author of the Killdash series, Godblood. Is a grim, dark short story with the audio runtime of 2 hours available on Audible and a digital print available for those that prefer reading. This exciting adventure is available now. But parents beware, it's not for the faint of heart. Stay tuned after the episode for an exclusive audio clip of Godblood. This is the Nerdy Old Men Podcast. Recognized by City View Magazine as best of the best in podcasts. And here are your hosts, the old bald man Chad and Redneck Wes. Good morning, Wes.
Morning there, Chad.
Yeah, remote because somebody broke their braces.
Yes, Kaylee decided to pop some brackets off yesterday at school and not tell us until she got home, and it was the whole thing. So we kind of had to juggle the schedule around a little bit, but we're still here.
That's all right.
Delivering the best podcast on the internet.
That's true. That's because we said so.
Or at least in our opinion.
Well, today we've got a really awesome author with us. You listeners, you know we really love our authors, and the cover got me right off the bat, but Bill Fawcett. Oh, yeah. Mr. Bill, how are you, sir?
Doing fine. Thank you for having me on.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. I guess let's just get started with just tell us about your book. For one, it's got, they say don't judge a book by the cover, but the cover is really awesome. And it is going to reach out and grab you especially folks that are into the kind of things that our listeners are into are really going to dig the development of this. So give us the pitch, because we talked earlier and I'm pretty fascinated.
Never Again. And yes, I love the Caleb Studios cover. He did a wonderful job getting the feel of the book into the cover, which is always a big advantage. Never Again is a book set in a hypothetical future where the Kurdish Republic forms sometime about now, which isn't too far flung, because the Kurds are an autonomous region and are occupying about a third of Syria at the moment anyhow. Right. That's one of the reasons the Turks are nervous about them. And the Kurdish people have been denied a homeland for about the last 700 years. And the British, they fought so well that the British didn't want to give them a homeland when they divided with the French up the Mideast. So the Kurdish people are in parts of many countries. This assumes that they took back those parts, but that makes the dictatorships and the failing religious theocracies around them very jealous of their success. So they're under tremendous pressure, going to be invaded. It's a very tense situation at the start. In fact, it starts with them driving a Syrian column of armor out. And the main character in the book, and we actually use several points of view, I'm proud to have for a mentor David Drake, and Harry Turtledove inspired the multiple point of view system of showing wars and in this book. But the central character is a gentleman who was a colonel in the armor who loses both his family and his mentor, his father figure, on the same day, and it changes him into someone who now is going to fanatically defend his nation. It's modeled on Genghis Khan, very honestly.
All right, yeah.
Who, from a nearby region. And the same attitude, the same kind of hardening. And the theory of it is that the Peshmerga, which is the Kurdish militia, the Kurdish army, is a very 700 years and they're still fighting. They're a very tough group of people, even in this world. And I'd idealize them a little, but not as much as you'd think sometimes. Right. And they're faced with an Iranian invasion and things are bad and he's depressed. And then some people show up and say, We've discontinued the Super Suit program, which is the Super Soldier program of DARPA today. And here's the designs and dies because we don't want them anymore. And DARPA thinks you're the place that could do it. Us guys at DARPA think we can give them to you because you're the ones who might do something with them. They have an Elon Musk type of scientist who also develops the battery that make them work. The problem with the Super Soldier program is they work beautifully. You can run, you can jump, you can carry large amounts of ammunition, heavy weapons, as long as you have a really long extension cord and a truck-sized generator next to you.
Well, that would limit their capability a bit, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it does tend to interfere with the scouting efforts.
Right.
And so the big leap of difference in this, that you're always allowed one, is that he's got the battery that will power them for several hours, which is a restriction. But these are early suits. These aren't super sophisticated Starship Trooper or John Ringo suits. These are sometimes awkward, spending too much time in them, and you have no idea where they chafe and itch. Think about 3 days in an armored suit. You itch.
Yeah.
And these are real people fighting desperately to defend their nation in new technology, some of which they're learning as they fight and die against overwhelming odds. I wrote the book because war is such a refiner of people, a showing of the best and worst in them. And of course, we also condemn local politicians, et cetera.
That's right.
It's too much fun to not do.
Of course.
And so I wrote this it's very consciously written. I've edited over 500 books in my 40-year career. I've written 27 nonfiction books. And I wrote this book to have fun, to show the war. So 2/3 of the chapters involve some sort of either combat or stressful situation. It's not a background book. This is the war. And it's seen through a number of people's eyes. And like, you're a soldier, you know things are bad, and somebody hands you a power suit with a rifle and a small anti-tank weapon on it. And you can throw grenades 200 yards.
Holy moly. Okay. Yeah.
It's
a force multiplier.
Definitely a force multiplier. And suddenly you, even the few hundreds that exist, can affect the war, can do things to them. And the fun part is, except for the battery, there's nothing in it that isn't technology we're either near to developing or have already developed today and is known publicly. Nothing secrets in this book, but known publicly that's been worked on or is being worked on today, from the camouflage to the equipment, except for the rail gun on one arm, because we can't make them that small. But given a really powerful battery, it would work. And the suit itself, the battery, letting the suit itself be a functional combat weapon. And then it also shows, along with the stress on the people, it shows you about the suit and the development of suit warfare.
Yeah, and I think that's neat because
two-thirds of the chat.
Go ahead. I just think that that's fascinating because I don't think that we're very far in reality from that type of combat being in existence.
No, not in the least. Some of us talk about, and it has drones in it, especially there's a little drone on every suit for scouting and targeting. Because we have computer programs now that will target, lock multiple targets. If I'm wearing a power suit, it can designate the targets of the drone while I'm still down on the ground. I can stand up, and it will move my arm for me to fire directly at all the silhouettes that I've marked.
See, I find that cool because, like, I play a lot of Battletech with a friend of mine, and there were things like that, you know, that were, quote-unquote, you know, sci-fi mm-hmm. 20 years ago. And like you said, we're not far away from stuff like that. And the fact that you've got it written into the book kind of gives it that realism that, you know, this is possible.
Well, there is something in existence right now that is, I can't remember the name of it, but the antenna is like a, it has little spikes sticking out all over the place. And I think it's Ricochet or something. I can't remember the name of the actual technology, but it will, it's an anti-sniper device. So it'll identify
where
it's
at.
Yep. And it'll turn a gun in that direction. And that exists today and has for quite some time. So the idea is not that far away.
No, we have sights. It'll only work one at a time right now, that if you lock it on a target, it will fire when the rifle's in the ideal position. You don't pull the trigger.
That's fascinating.
And it's all computerized for height, range, you can put in the wind.
So you've done a lot of research into this. And so we're talking about the Kurds are the protagonist of this, right?
And then that's correct. The Kurdish Nate Republic.
Right. And then Iran is your antagonist in this. Correct. Is that
Syria and Iran are the threat, and it opens with them ending the threat against Syria with more conventional weapons. And a few months later, they know that Iran's going to act, because as it is, and at least was, the mullahs are unpopular and broke, and they need an outside victory and a country to pillage to restore their position with their people and the riots in the cities, etc. It's idealistic. And I have to admit it. If I'm going to write a near future science fiction military book, along with the satisfaction of the military, I gave myself the satisfaction of beating up the Iranians. It just seemed to be smart.
The big bad guy of the region. And
if I'm going to beat someone up, I want it to be satisfying. Nobody mythical.
That's true. So these super suits that the guys are wearing, is it Mark One? Is that what you're calling them? MK1, Mark One?
Well, we're calling them GOGs. The books are labeled. There are four books in the series. So I'll be out by the end of the year.
Great.
If you enjoy it, there is more. There's Never Again, then No Fail, which is basically, if you defeat the Iranians, I don't want to give the end away, but does anyone really think I'd let the bad guys win in the first volume? And then there's No Fail, where they turn to their nuclear arsenal, and the GOGs have to go, the suits have to go in and stop a nuclear attack. Then the third one is mercenaries and Syrians come in on No Further and evade, because I think the suits have all been lost during the raids on the Iranians. Right. And then the last book is called, named after the fact that they, it's one of the columns that flanks and gets behind the Syrian invasion. These are the perfect light cavalry or light infantry. You can flank, you can outmove, you can run 30 miles an hour. Now, they've got disadvantages, these suits, because any large caliber weapon's still going to punch through anything that can be carried on them. You're not going to stop a 50.
Right.
And obviously not a tank round. And tanks are still a risk. Machine guns are a risk. I mean, casualties are going to be nasty, because you're wearing a moving protection item with a lot of weapons, but you're not immune to the battle.
Right.
And so you've got these disadvantages, and so you have to use strategies very similar to that which was used by various forms of light infantry and cavalry. So such as the Zulu MPs, which were a version of this for a different technology, or the Mongolian light horsemen. You don't go head on into their strength. You go around, you cut it off, you fall back and get them in disarray and then hit them from the sides. These historical things become very useful again with the technology of the suits in a modern warfare. Also, tanks are much more vulnerable from the side.
So yeah, they're not but that puts an element of danger in the story for good guys, because they're not marching through everything. Right. Yeah.
The casualty rate on something that's firing a lot of weapons and can be seen by everybody on the battlefield as you stride through at 6.5-7 feet tall is pretty high.
Right.
This is a lot about the sacrifice and the courage of the Kurdish Peshmerga.
Yeah, you probably can't hide too well in that.
No. You can't even sit in it. It's something that they constantly complain about, along with the chafing from wearing. Imagine wearing an iron suit for 2 or 3 days, even with pads.
Wow.
Things are going to chafe and itch.
Yep.
And this, you can imagine what soldiers say about it. We clean up the phrasing. by the way, the suits are called GOGs, from the same inspiration of why armored vehicles are called tanks. Do you know why tanks are called tanks?
When they were shipped in World War One
from Britain.
World War One, they put tank out of water tank. Something like it. Yeah,
absolutely. And so in code, everyone
called it tank.
Yeah, everyone in code, they just kept referring to them as the tanks, so the Germans wouldn't know, because they did come as a great surprise on the front. And these were shipped into the Kurdish Republic, labeled General Ordnance Garment. GOG in the big letters.
Dog.
So we call them GOGs. And later on, we developed one that is larger and can carry heavier weapons, and we call it Major Armament General Ordnance Garment. And yes, part of why I originally put this together was so that Gog and Magog could ramp into the East.
Nice.
The biblical quote.
Absolutely. That's very cool. I like that a lot. You know, my partner Wes is a big history degree guy, and I saw on your bio here, you've done some pretty interesting, was this historical mistakes series?
Yes, as all my friends and wife will attest, I'm an expert at mistakes.
I can relate to that.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that, Bill, because that like I said, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I've done 12 books on this topic, each one of which contains 100 mistakes. And my theory is that it isn't the plans of brilliant leaders, generally, that mold history. The thing that changes and affects history the most is what goes wrong, what somebody does wrong, what happens wrong. And hundreds and hundreds of examples, obviously, from this many books. And it's a look at those events from the accidental bombing of London that led to the bombing of Berlin, that led to the changing of targets in the Battle of Britain from the Royal Air Force bases, where Churchill was ready to leave. They changed to London, gave the bases a break, and they turned around. And it only happened because some bombers accidentally dumped their bombs over what they thought was countryside, and it was really London's east side. But they got back and reported they dumped them on countryside. So when the 3 days later in revenge, the British Air Force sent 90 bombers over Berlin and bombed the city terribly ineffectively. The only casualty was an elephant in the Berlin Zoo had a heart attack.
Oh, gosh. That's interesting.
But it was right after Goering had given his, you can call me Meyer, which means you can call me a Jew if anyone can ever attack our homeland. 2 days later, we bombed Berlin. He was furious. Hitler was furious. And they'd broken the unspoken agreement that World War II started with, that you never bomb civilian centers. And both sides had honored it until this occurred. But the British thought the Germans did it. The German airmen did it by mistake and never reported it. So the Germans thought the British had done it, and it made World War II much more intense. But if Hitler hadn't gotten so mad that we're just going to bomb London now, and he directly forced over Gallen's protest that happening, the British were losing the Battle of Britain and probably would have, and history would be massively different. I do a whole section, Adolf Hitler's great for mistakes. He was so good at them. In 1944, a group of British Rangers said, we have a viable plot to assassinate Hitler. And Churchill stopped it because he said, don't do that. Someone competent might take over.
That's so cool.
I start with ancient Rome and I take the attitude, basically the way I just said it. And the names of the books are You Did What? Yeah, 101 Mistakes That Changed History, 101 Stumbles in the March of History.
Yep.
Trust Me, 100 Executive Mistakes That Changed History. And we just we have fun. And on some of them, we also talk about what would have happened if the mistake had not been made. And I have some guest writers like Harry Turtledove and Eric Flint who contribute to them. So it's a fun series. There's some of them still out there, and you get used copies everywhere. And 100 series, or three, are available still on Amazon for new copies. That's also sort of inspires here, because as the side who makes the least mistakes win wars, and that's also reflected in this book. The competent but egotistical general loses to the desperate people, basically. And I also wrote it, so it's fun. It's good to feel, to read. It's hopefully a page turner. There's a lot of, we have six different perspectives of the war, and it's a very, as Wellington said, a near run thing.
I think that something that appeals to me is I always like, I love history, and Wes does too, and I like alternate history things and looking back at exactly. Now, this appeals to me, so I've got to find these mistakes series from you, because I think that stuff is really cool. I really dig that kind of stuff, and I'm looking forward to finding that. Another thing that I see on your bio here that is something near and dear to mine and Wes's hearts, looks like you did a little something for Dragon Magazine once upon a time.
I had articles before Dragon started. I lived near Lake Geneva. I wasn't part of the original D&D group. But my DM was, and we were playtesting the game, the what became 2 and then 3, D&D 2 and 3, mimeo pages, in fact, on some of them on occasion, as Gary and Dave created it before Dave Arneson left. And by then it was just Gary at the end. And so I did articles. I did the center. Basically, I did the nerd centerfold of Dragon Magazine for the first 45 issues. we did Game Aids. We did your chosen crossword path adventures. We did new classes. I did an article that nearly got me lynched about it. We have demons, so I did angels. Oh, you want to guess what the fundamentalist thought of me after that?
That's awesome.
It was the second time I ever got hate mail. The first time, the first time I got hate mail out of 2 for my gaming background. Then after. And after, by the way, my wife is Jody Lynn Nye, the author. And while I was doing this, she was dating the president of the company. So I never talked to her then. I met her 10 years later.
Right.
Wow. Oh, really?
Yes. And she was at 19, handwritten manuscript by Gary, and told, type these books up for us. We'll give you $1 a page. And her summer job was to type the DMG Player's Manual and Monster Manual for Gary.
Oh, my God.
For the original hardcovers.
Really?
And made some of it, sometimes made them into sentences and stuff. So a 19-year-old, another nerd, did that for her boyfriend at $1 a word. And I'd seen her, but, you know, cute young thing. But that's the boss's girlfriend, so we all have wide circles. 10 years later, I met her. And I didn't know... We dated for 4 months before I found out that was her again.
Oh, wow. That's a small world,
and,
right?
And all of a sudden, you're dead. And she knew I was in gaming. Story, though. But I didn't know her background. Actually, it was embarrassing. We went to Winterfest. It was before before there was a Gen Con. Every winter, we gathered at the Legion Hall in Lake Geneva. And I was taking her up because I was a big, important person. By then, I had founded Mayfair Games, which is why I stopped writing for Dragon. I was a competitor now. Did the Roll Aids line of modules. And I'm going to come in and introduce her to all my important friends in gaming because I knew she'd play D&D. She walks in and they ignore me, and I'll go throw arms around her. They've known her longer than me. I look at her and she goes, yeah, I'll tell you about it.
and as a gamer, right? And you're like, what?
Yeah, well, exactly. And right then I knew I had to marry her. She was that much smarter than me. I'd better not think that and let it go.
My goodness. That's fascinating. That's so cool. Well, when I opened up the bio and I was like, holy moly, Dragon Magazine, I had a subscription. And then the Choose the Path novels, by TSR?
I wrote the first chosen path the sniper modules, which are the first chosen path modules.
Yes.
For TSR. Before I went to Mayfair, I did four sniper chosen paths for them, where I've always been interested in military. And then I helped put together some fantasy chosen paths, and then wrote four more of those for Ace. And then they said, hey, that's great. Recruit some other authors and get us sets. And both Ace and Tor did some more chosen paths after that. So I had the privilege of doing some of the first ones literally for them and that for TSR, and then going on to work with some of the big name authors of the day, Anne McCaffrey, Roger Zelazny, and do chosen path novels in their world. They're collector's items now, which shows how old I've gotten.
Well, just the fact that you said that you worked on like second edition, which is what
we started on.
Ed and I came in on
D&D 2,
that's really neat.
It was fun, and it was a really different and wonderful. The creative feeling was amazing. New ground. Gary was brilliant. I always loved Gary. He was a good friend. And he did amazing. He carried this. He carried the thing on the enthusiasm of what he was doing. And we were breaking new ground. And once it got really popular, of course, everyone's going, wow, look at this, look at that. And we're going, yeah, isn't it fun? We're just nerds having fun.
Right.
And you're paying us to do it now. I mean, I was working full time for the insurance industry a trainer, and I would sneak away any chance I could and design games. And in fact, I sort of have that joy of, I think things you read should have the joy we had and the joy we created with the modules and the early gaming material. Mm-hmm. And it's carried through even to this book. This book is not meant to be great literature. It's meant to be really good fun. There's combat in three quarters of the chapters, because after all, what's a movie without car chases and explosions?
Obviously, yeah.
And strong characters, and yes, we manipulate emotions, so does war. And so we reflect, it's all consistent through my background, the irreverence and the fun of the mistakes, and up to a serious look, but one in which you want to know what happens. You enjoy reading in my fantasy and science fiction books and my mystery novels as well. So that was formulative for me too. And I went on to Mayfair Games, and you mentioned BattleTech. Their office was the door next to mine. Fast enough shut an office those first years when we couldn't afford rent anywhere.
Oh, that's crazy.
I love how this whole world is interconnected. It's all built towards, you know, you writing these books and being able to do all this stuff. That, to me, is so cool how it's all tied together.
Absolutely. And did you ever make a mistake in life where you knew if you'd done something slightly different, you'd have really scored, really done so much better, but you didn't?
Every day.
Well, when we shared the offices, Ross and Jody and us were talking, and the people who founded FASA, by the way, it stands for Fredonian Aerospace Administration, Rufus T. Firefly President. It's Marx Brothers.
Marx Brothers. Yes, that's right.
And so we're sitting around, and I go, you know, we had to do a game where you switch out modules in the little robots on the board, and you can do a combat game, because we just finished doing War on the Falklands, which is another time the press beat me up. And I got hate mail as the designer of that, because we got the game out before the war ended. And I'm very proud. I'm part Irish. I'm half Irish. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing better for an Irishman than I was denounced by name in Parliament at one point.
Yes. Yes, sir.
That got me Guinness all over Ireland for a while.
I love that. That's fantastic.
For doing War in the Falklands. Anyhow, and I said, hey, guys, let's do a game with little modules in the robots. And my side said, well, we're too busy doing this game and this game. You guys want to do it? Oh, sure, we'll do it. And they came out with the game. It's called Combots. And then they said, hey, we could make miniatures of this. And they came out with the miniature version called BattleTech. And I gave them all the rights, because it's a crazy idea anyhow.
Oh, man.
I'm sitting here looking at my BattleTech minis right now.
If I had done it, it wouldn't have been half as brilliant or half as inspired. And they were part of the conversation that created it. I'm not saying I created it. I'm saying I was sitting there and I could have done that game with them. And I'm really busy doing this game based on David Drake's Hammer Slammers right now. You guys play with this idiot idea. I could have had money.
Well, I gotta tell you this stuff. If one, your new book sounds absolutely fascinating, and right before the or right as you were just describing it, I got on Audible and purchased it because I'm looking forward to listening to that. But before we get into anything else, I just want to tell you you did work on some early D&D stuff, and from a guy, and I know I'm speaking for Wes too, that D&D is still a huge part of our life. We play once a month. Luckily, we still live relatively close to each other, so we still play with the same crew that we did back in the day, except for a few more people. And it meant so very much to us back in our youth. And it was an escape from the real world, an escape from stresses and problems and things like that. And it joined our friend group together as brothers, and we're still that way today. So for what part you played in it, we thank you very much.
Very little, but it was a privilege to work with the giants like Gary and Dave and Frank and Kim, Dave Anderson, Frank Mentzer, Kim Mohan, etc. Because it was the feeling of being able to just sit there and just have ideas and then bring them into fruition was a life rewarding experience that changed it. I could never go back to insurance. No. I had to go to Mayfair.
So that's what set you along the path. That's great.
It set me along the path of self-unemployed, or as we like to point out to anyone, you want to be a writer or a game person? Go ahead. You can work anytime you want as long as you can pick the 60 hours a week you spend on it.
That's great. Wes, I think since Bill's such a good sport that that we ought to introduce him to the rapid fire question session. You want to do that?
I think so.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
We have ambushed him here.
We did.
You know, I'm in California at 7:00 in the morning.
Well, you're brilliant though, so it shouldn't be a big problem for you. Yeah. And we only do this with guests that we really like, so that's what we're doing. And what we'll ask you just some silly questions, and so the first answer that comes to your head it will be your answer. So, you ready?
Okay.
Okay, Wes.
All right.
Go for it.
We'll start off with a good one here. Coke or Pepsi?
Coke. I'm from Atlanta.
Okay, all right. Wes works for Pepsi.
I'm
blowing
off the call now.
I haven't seen Pepsi in months.
All right, Star Wars or Star Trek?
Star Trek, definitely Star Trek. I have the honor of working.
Go ahead.
No, I have the honor of working with a number of them: Armin Shimerman, Roxanne Dawson. Yes. Scotty did books with me in my book career. I had the honor of working with some of them, and it's brilliant. Those people there are brilliant.
Yeah, Armin's been on our show. Yeah. Yep.
Isn't he great?
He's fantastic.
I'm the guy who got him right. I'm the guy who did the books with him that got him started.
Really? Yes.
Him and Mike did the first books. I was the guy who was the editor and publisher of them.
Nice.
I worked for the publisher.
Armin's a great guy. So he's
wonderful, and he's so generous of his time. He runs a theater just to teach new actors. He's been doing it for almost 30 years now.
It's fantastic. Yeah. And he's out in your area too, though. I know he's in Los Angeles, or he worked for USC or something like that. So, but anyway, he's a fantastic guy. So, all right, Wes.
Okay.
Okay. You get to pick any vehicle from the 80s. Keys are in it. It's gassed up, ready to go. TV, it doesn't matter what, movies, whatever. What are you jumping in?
Well, there's this car that if you get 80 miles an hour in a straight line, you can lose your time. I don't think if I can do anything from anywhere, and it's not the Enterprise, you want the 80s. That's about when those were. Yeah, I'm going back to the future. No question about it.
And oh, that's great.
I want to meet my wife 10 years earlier and try and compete.
There you go. That's like great. That's great. All right. Just a couple more. Let's see. one of Wes's that he likes. You've got to go into battle, so you can take any weapon from history, science fiction movies, whatever, with the exception of your battle suits out of your book. What are you going to?
Oh,
go
I wouldn't get into those things. They're death threats.
All right. So what are you fighting the good fight with?
I think if I've got to go into battle, I got to go big and strong and get in a BattleTech mech.
There you go. That's a great one. Yep.
Side question. Which mech would it be? Is it a Warhammer? Is it a Rifleman, Bushwhacker, Titan?
I think I'd go with a Bushwhacker. I want fast and nimble and hard to target.
Oh, our buddy Jason will be happy to hear that because he has beaten the crap out of me many times with a Bushwhacker.
When they put the video game out, the little booth game back when they were still primitive, they had a big thing and they invited us all to come play, and Jordy got in the smallest, lightest unit they had and ran among us and killed seven of us in under 10 minutes.
Sounds right.
That's Jordan Weissman, the guy who inspired that, the half a faster.
Nice. Okay, well, I guess I'll hit him with the most difficult question because it's 7 o'clock in the morning there.
Yes, go ahead.
And okay. we have been threatened bodily harm with this question. It is very controversial, so... Does pineapple go on a pizza?
Absolutely, totally not. Never. I might leave the room.
That's good.
I'm from Chicago originally.
Oh, there you go.
I think there's a state law against that, just like Pepsi in Georgia.
Yeah, it's like in New York City, we've been banned from New York City. So,
yeah. absolutely. Look, if you guys are, I'm not going to sign the release now.
You win.
Blasphemy, I just can't tolerate.
That's great. So before we let you go, man, for one thing, we really appreciate you getting up early out there on the West Coast and talking to us about your amazing work. Can you tell our listeners where they can keep up with your work and where they can find it? Obviously, I mentioned earlier, it is available on Audible. I'm a big audiobook guy. I also like to have paper books in my office in here, but so I've already got that on audio. But where else can people find your stuff?
We have a website for the series called bloodandarmor.com. And we have excerpts. We even have wallpaper you can download from it, from that wonderful cover. I couldn't resist it. Every cover will have wallpaper. Also, Chris Crenity Press, who is the publisher of the book. And you can find my books all over Amazon. So have fun. And, of course, they're all available on Amazon. So if someone wants Never Again, they can get the Audible. They can get the print. They can get the ebook. It's also on Kindle Unlimited. Look on any of them. Put in Never Again by Bill Fawcett, F-A-W-C-E-T-T, and it'll pop up. And hopefully you'll have as much fun reading it as I did writing it, because I learned a lot of things in 50 years of editing. And one of them, 45, let's be honest, 45 years of editing. I'm getting older than I am, and that's pretty old if you think about the early D&D. We're talking 75 there.
Right.
I had as much fun writing it as I hope someone will have fun reading it. And I learned working with the greats that when they wrote what they loved, it came out best. Roger Zelazny didn't think anyone was even going to buy Nine Princes of Amber. He put it in a drawer until he won a Hugo. And he'd written it over a summer in a burst. He did 200,000 words in 2 months. And he was sure it must be terrible. Put it in a drawer. And then when he won, Lester Del Rey said, "Hey, Lord of Light won a Hugo. I need another book from you now to follow up on it." And he said, "Well, here's something I wrote, but it's probably terrible." It was the first two volumes of Nine Princes in Amber. So when you write what you love, and this was something I loved writing, I think people have more fun reading it too.
Yes, it shows through. Your love of the subject and stuff shows through. So that's good stuff. So everybody go look at it. You know, Amazon's a good place for it, but give us a shout out to your current publisher for this book as well. So that way people can reach out.
This is Chris Kennedy Publishing, Theogony Press, and it's Never Again by Bill Fawcett. And the one coming out in a month and another 2 months after, the next one coming out is No Fail, which puts them in an even more stressful condition when they've got newts aimed at your little country, and you got to stop them, or it doesn't matter that you got technology. It's a no-fail mission.
Man, that's intense. And I look forward to that.
Oh, it is.
So, Bill, hang on with us on the phone for just a minute until after the show is over. We want to talk to you for a minute. So, guys,
go
check out Bill's stuff, man. It's fascinating. We're excited. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, it's the Old Bald Man Chad with Redneck Wes.
No pineapple, yeehaw.
Now, a sample of Lee Ellis's God Blood.
Came up for Rogot's belly. He parried, elbowed Garagot in the teeth, then slammed him into a tree. Through the tree, and out the other side, and into the dirt. Splinters fell all around, and the severed tree came falling, crushing a giant mushroom to the earth. Garagot kicked Rogot, and he went soaring, flipped backwards and crashed down 20 paces away. The Mushroom King was up and after him. Rogot grabbed his axe, pulling up a handful of leaves with it, and leapt to his feet. Their weapons collided, and they were at it again, snarling, hacking, shoving and punching, god blood thumping in their veins. Garagot thrusted the flat side of his blade hard against Rogot's axe, pressed him back, then shoved a crust-covered finger deep into Rogot's ear.